State Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Characterization and Remediation of Fractured Rock. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover introductory material on the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our ITRC team. Today's training is based on the ITRC guidance document, Characterization and Remediation of Fractured Rock. We're going to introduce you to the guidance today, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use throughout today's training class. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. The trainers control the slides today. If you would like to, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where we started today. Throughout today's training, we do welcome you to enter in questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. In some cases, we'll get right back to you with answers. In other cases, we'll ask those questions out loud during our question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end of the presentation. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. This is the first time we're offering this class to the public, so it's going to help us improve this training course. We're also developing several new training courses, and your feedback is something we use when working on those training courses. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. And right now, it's only through the feedback form. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, itrcweb.org. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholder. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We do encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We do ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC users policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of guidance documents available. Our online schedule for the rest of this year is available. There's also opportunity to join new teams, join the ITRC annual meeting. Lots of great ways to become more involved. I'll introduce our trainers. Short bios are available for the CLUIN training page, and we've included a link at the bottom of this slide and the next slide. Our first trainer today will be Michael Smith at the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. Jeff Hale is from Kleinfelder. Michael Gafal is from Anchor QEA. Ted Tyler is from Kleinfelder. We also have Ryan Wymore at CDM Smith, Dan Bryant at Woodard and Curran, and John Daugherty at CDM Smith. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Michael Smith at the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. Michael?
Thanks, Juliana. I guess I'll start with why we started working on this document a few years ago. Everybody, I think, in the business realizes that we've had problems with fractured rock sites. I mean, we don't achieve cleanup goals very often. We can spend a lot of time and money, but you still have risk, it still remains. We often just consider it too complex and default to pump and treat for long-term monitoring. And unfortunately, some of the problems include the fact that we haven't really adopted the conventional approaches really don't reflect the new understanding of fractured rock. There's a lot of data out there which we just sort of forgot about or don't look at. So the idea of this document was to sort of give people resources to work with fractured rock and actually come up with better outcomes. I mean, common site challenges, this is a picture of columnar basalt in Iceland, and you can tell it's complex. Imagine getting fractures in there and trying to figure out where materials are going. So we have an incomplete understanding of a really complex groundwater flow and contaminant transport regime in fractured rock. There's also difficulties in site investigation, including the cost of the investigation. With unconsolidated materials, you can direct push, you can do quickly get a lot of data. With fractured rock, you have to pretty much drill monitoring wells, not a lot of direct push due to granites. So it costs more, and you get less data. And you also have unrealistic remedial objectives. And some of this is driven by state regulatory agencies, and we have to follow what our regulations say, but we also have to start figuring out how to get the most realistic remediation that we can. And then that often the selective remedy has been ineffective. We've seen that plenty of times. So here's another picture. This is from Colorado. Again, it is complicated, but we're going to try to dispel that myth and say, yeah, these sites really can be cleaned up. I mean, it's difficult, but it's not impossible. So certainistic, what we call our expanding pyramid of uncertainty and cost. This just gives an idea of where the problems start. I mean, we start with, yeah, the rock sites are complex. And building on that, that leads to not very good CSM, a lot of uncertainty, unfamiliarity with tools, unrealistic REOs, remedial action objectives. Then we go to not only the unfamiliarity of tools, the inefficient use of tools, the increased characterization costs, and then more importantly, the continued CSM uncertainty. You have to have a good CSM to do a good job. And so finally, we can come up with an ineffective remedial design. Again, increased remediation costs and operational time, and less likely to achieve REOs than we would in a more conventional site. Now, we do think we have a sort of nature of solution where we can build upon different knowledge, different things we gain. Start with, we have to understand fracture rock site characteristics. What are the characteristics of a fracture rock? How does contaminants flow? How does groundwater flow? That's the starting point to understand that. Then building on that, once you have a better understanding, you can actually develop an initial CSM that really can help you get focused. And it also helps you use appropriate tools in a logical manner and continually revise and optimize the CSM as you go along. Then this will help us establish SMART objectives, SMART being specific, measurable, applicable, relevant, and time-bound. That's pretty important. And so you get informed remedial design and optimizing your monitoring strategy with the SMART objectives. And finally, you get an effective remedy and achieve your REOs, hopefully. So what we've done is we think that this document will help guide you doing some of this, or help to guide you with this. We can't in 2 hours give a lesson on how to characterize fracture rock, but we're trying to introduce you to the document, which can help be a guide and provide a lot of references. So where to supply basically any site with fractured rock, or whether it's igneous rock or metamorphic sedimentary, just any site where you have contamination in the bedrock. And when to apply any contaminant, chlorinated solvents, petroleum, coal tar, creosote, metals, emerging contaminants like PFAS. We have a site in southern Vermont where they have over 250 wells contaminated, private wells contaminated with PFAS above standards. So it's becoming a big issue. We have new sites we're characterizing for the first time. You might want to use this guidance to help you. And also on existing sites, if you have to go back to an old site and try to optimize what you're doing, stop wasting money, this could help, you know, help you do that and also help you get away from the default to contaminant long-term monitoring. So our knowledge and our goal is to grow your skills. And we think if you use this document to guide your decision-making, you can, you know, again, go back to the develop the quality CSM. That's important. That's probably the bedrock of everything. Set realistic remedial objectives. Select the best remedial options that you're able to do. And how to monitor remedial progress and assess your results. And also important with this is when you're looking at a bedrock site, you really need a team. It can't be just one person managing the site, but if you look at a big complex site, you need a team, structural geologists, hydrogeologists, engineers. So if you use this document, your team can be confident and effective decisions and go beyond this containment and monitoring. I mean, actually, in some cases, restore bedrock groundwater. It's their goal. So what we've done is we picked our little puzzle pieces. We look at this as a puzzle. So building a conceptual site model, you really need, first of all, the geology, the hydrology or hydrogeology, and the chemistry. And these all fit together to help you go towards a fate and understanding of fate and transport. And don't try to read this on here. This is just telling you what we're going to go through. For each of these key puzzle pieces of geology, hydrology, and chemistry in the document, we have physical characteristics. We talk about the fracture flow, and we provide information on how to understand it, how to fit these pieces together. And then we also talk about the similarities and differences in bedrock versus unconsolidated materials. Again, don't try to read these. They are in the document, and we'll talk about it more. So here's our roadmap for the day, connecting us to the guidance. Get one, we're going to identify the similarities and differences, fractured rock, unconsolidated sites, and really talk about the geology chapters 2 through 4 in the hydrogeology and the chemistry. And then chapter 5, we're going to recognize the skills, approaches, and tools. And we are going to introduce a tools table to help you figure out how to characterize fracture rock sites and get the best information for the best CSMs. The chapter 6 is applying remedial approved approaches to develop remedial action objectives that will actually work and be reasonable, how you select a remedy. And then once you've got the remedy in place, development of a monitoring strategy for fractured rock sites. So I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Jeff Hale. Jeff?
Thank you, Michael. As we build our site conceptual model, it's important to understand aspects of bedrock geology that affect groundwater flow and contaminant transport. Some of these bedrock characteristics include structural tectonics, bedrock types, rock structures, and microtextures. These bedrock characteristics are often analogous to familiar aspects of unconsolidated geology, as we've shown on this slide. Many of these bedrock features that affect fluid flow are expressed in the regional landscape or terrain. So we first look at terrain analysis when we embark on our investigation to build the bedrock site conceptual model. It's really the box top to the jigsaw puzzle. In the next few slides, we'll go through that. So terrain analysis is really an assessment of the topography, the drainage, and the landforms of a site area. It provides a big picture or regional view of the site setting, which is largely influenced by the underlying bedrock characteristics. This example here illustrates how the northeast to southwest trend in the landscape and the arrangement of the physiographic provinces provide an initial clue to bedrock structure and the groundwater flow characteristics. So when you look at this figure, you know, what direction would you expect for groundwater to flow in this setting, and how would you expect this setting to affect surface hydrology? So taking a closer look at the geology, a closer look at the type of rock or the lithology and the rock structure, such as layering or folding or faulting of the rock, reveals how these features can affect groundwater flow and the surface hydrology. In this example, a stream is formed along the layers or foliation of a metamorphic rock. This layering can impart a directional component to groundwater flow, known as anisotropy, and it can also influence the location and orientation of surface water features that also affect groundwater flow. In this case, the stream incised along the metamorphic foliation is a groundwater discharge feature. So we can combine this initial information with knowledge of site-specific release characteristics to create an initial conceptual site model, even before you begin your intrusive investigation. The initial CSM helps guide subsequent investigation activities, such as monitoring well installation, and also helps identify potential receptors that might be affected. The example presented here illustrates 6 scenarios for contaminant migration from a source to a potential receptor by combining desktop information about the source location, the inferred hydraulic gradient, bedrock influence on flow, such as anisotropy, and hydrologic features such as a small stream and a large river. So really 6 different scenarios when you put different site-specific characteristics together that can help point you in the right direction with your more intrusive investigation. So the example here is intended to be more of a complete example to help illustrate terrain analysis. So the graphic shown here provides, as I said, it's a complete example of terrain analysis that's corroborated by data from hundreds of monitoring wells. Those are the dark blue dots. It is evident that the contaminant, in this case an L-NAPL, represented by the yellow dots, infiltrated along the tilted layers of schist. There's a photograph of the schist set in the slide. And upon encountering groundwater in bedrock, the L-NAPL migrated along the northeast southwest orientation, or the strike of the bedrock, which is also expressed in the ridges and valleys of the regional landscape, toward the headwaters of local streams in the area that are incised along the bedrock layering. In this instance, the site is surrounded by hundreds of private supply wells in all directions. These are the light blue dots. But relatively few of those wells were actually affected due to the influence of the bedrock and the groundwater flow direction, which was essentially linear due to the bedrock anisotropy. So transitioning from that example to one of the tools that's in the guidance document, I want to talk about this terrain analysis matrix. So within the guidance document on fractured rock, we included a terrain analysis matrix. It breaks down terrain analysis into its component parts, making for a more methodical assessment of these characteristics. These aspects of terrain analysis are organized into columns in the terrain analysis matrix, which are shown here, which includes examples and illustrations of features and characteristics to look for when you're characterizing your site. Working left to right on the terrain analysis matrix, these features include the location of potential receptors. These may include supply wells, seeps, surface water bodies. Then we have the regional setting. I mentioned before the physiographic province. That's important initial information when you're doing your terrain analysis. In the third column, we have the bedrock lithology or the stratigraphy. What rock types are you dealing with, and do they exhibit any internal layering that may affect fluid flow? We also have to consider the rock structure. Have the rocks been tilted, twisted, deformed, or faulted in a way that could affect fluid flow or storage? Anisotropy and heterogeneity are very important. Do these features impart any directionality or non-uniformity to the groundwater flow? And these types of features can be expressed in the pattern of the regional landscape or terrain. And hydrology, the water component. Are there surface water features superimposed within the fabric of the bedrock or regional terrain that may influence groundwater hydraulically, such as a discharge boundary? So when you embark on your bedrock site characterization and you want to conduct your initial terrain analysis, this matrix is a good tool to break it down into its component parts and figure out what the bedrock influence on groundwater flow might be. So the next and last slide in my portion is brief information on karst. The document doesn't take on karst terrain directly, but karst terrain develops when fractured soluble bedrock interacts with surface water or groundwater to develop macro-scale secondary porosity features, such as voids or conduits, sinkholes, or caves. This can result in a fairly complex hydrogeologic system within the bedrock. These features may also significantly affect groundwater flow in karst bedrock. So this phenomenon and its associated terrains are further discussed in Appendix A of the Fractured Rock Guidance Document. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mike Gefell of Anchor QEA, who will talk about the hydrology of fractured rock.
Thanks, Jeff. So the second major piece of the CSM puzzle is the hydrology of fractured rock, which is all about how fluids flow through the rock. And the primary focus of the guidance document is groundwater, but we also consider non-aqueous phase liquids or NAPLs. Let's bring up another poll question now. Okay, so which of these is the most important for determining flow in a fractured rock setting? So to evaluate fluid flow in bedrock, which of these factors is most important? Is it where is the fluid? Are there multiple phases? Or how does it move? And you can use your voting tool to cast your ballot on this question. And while the responses are coming in, let's return to figure 1-1, which we saw earlier. This is the middle portion of that figure, and it's a nice reference to help compare and contrast factors that affect fluid flow in fractured rock versus porous media. In the next several slides, we'll take a high-level look at how fluid flow occurs in fractured rock formations. Suffice it to say that we will focus on the structure of the rock, the fractures, which is where a lot of the action is in terms of flow, and also the unfractured matrix. So based on the poll question, there's a really dominant answer here, which is how does it move? How do the fluids move? And that is, it's a compelling result. All of these factors come into play, though, where the fluid is, are there multiple phases, and depending on site-specific considerations or where you are in the project, you may consider any of them. But certainly, how the fluids move is crucial for the overall hydrogeologic picture. Okay, so we can then discontinue that poll question. Okay. In fractured rock, flow is dominated by the fractures themselves because they are basically like miniature open flow zones, like little pipes, except approximately planar and intersecting with other ones. So the bedrock characteristics that control fluid flow are largely fracture characteristics. Fracture orientations are really important because they control the directions that fluids can flow most easily. The fracture width is called its aperture. It's like the aperture of a camera lens, the size of the opening. If solid materials precipitate in fractures, or if fine-grained material gets deposited in a fracture, in a process generally known as infilling, the aperture decreases. And so fluid flow is slower in that case, or it's hindered. Fracture density and connectivity refer to how many fractures there are in a given section of rock and how well the fractures are connected. The matrix is the portion of the rock that's not fractured. It consists of blocks of rock bounded on all sides by fractures. Although the matrix permeability is often extremely low, it can represent a significant storage zone for chemicals that diffuse into it from the fractures. So this is some of the terminology you'll see in the guidance and that we'll use during this training session. Primary considerations for flow in sedimentary versus crystalline rock. So these are two broad classes of fractured rock. In this photograph, you see a sequence of horizontally bedded red, brown, and gray sedimentary rock layers in the top half of the figure. This is the Grand Canyon, if you didn't recognize it. So this sequence here is sedimentary rock horizontally bedded. And at the bottom of the photograph, we have this amorphous sort of massive-looking brown rock, and that's crystalline bedrock. And in sedimentary rock, predominant fractures often form parallel to the bedding, and other fractures may cut steeply across the bedding. Sedimentary rock layers with higher hydraulic conductivity, or K, may be practically separated by low permeability or low K strata. Rock composition can affect weathering in sedimentary rock. For example, carbonate rocks like limestone may partially dissolve along fractures, increasing fracture apertures and therefore increasing flow potential. In this figure, we see layers of crystalline rock, and there's a zone here that is relatively fractured. There's a higher density of fractures here. And in this zone, the dark red conceptually shows a dense non-aqueous phase liquid, which has come down from ground surface and gotten into those fractures, and it has also gotten into this underlying, more competent layer. In this more fractured zone here, the flow is relatively diffuse. The flow is more sort of continuously distributed, and there's a dissolved phase plume that we see migrating down gradient from where the denapple has gone in. Also, this diffuse yellow appearance shows conceptually that the plume has diffused into the blocks of the matrix. In this more competent fractured rock zone down here, we see fewer fractures. They're spaced farther apart. And in this zone, conceptually, the matrix has much lower porosity and therefore less mass has diffused into the matrix blocks. Fracture systems in crystalline rock may be somewhat orderly in layered formations like this, but they can also be pretty chaotic in intrusive igneous rocks like granite. In any case, it's important to evaluate fracture orientations to understand predominant flow direction. So it's the flow that drives how we investigate fractured rock sites. And we consider the roles of the unfractured rock matrix, discrete individual fractures, and interconnected fracture networks. In most well-lithified rocks, the matrix is practically impermeable compared to the fractures. So matrix flow is usually extremely slow. Each individual fracture or discrete fracture can convey fluid flow at a rate that is proportional to the aperture of the fracture to the third power. So the fluid flow rate in a fracture strongly depends on its aperture. In some cases, a discrete fracture may be relatively large and prominent. In some sedimentary rock sequences, for example, an individual bedding plane fracture can be traced across an entire site and may be the main flow path for a chemical plume. Usually, though, it is the overall interconnected fractured network that we focus on in investigations, because collectively, interconnected groups of fractures can accommodate the most overall flow. So far, we've focused on the physical aspects of the rock, but we also need to consider the dynamics of the fluids themselves. Any fluid in any medium flows in response to pressure and density gradients. When combined, they produce a hydraulic gradient, which causes the fluid phase to flow from high to low potential energy. We characterize hydraulic gradients by measuring and mapping water levels in wells and piezometers. Flow can be either laminar or turbulent. Laminar flow is also known as Darcy flow, in which the flow rate is proportional to the hydraulic gradient. For most site investigations, it is assumed that the flow is laminar. However, in some cases, flow in rock can be turbulent or non-Darcy flow. This situation arises in cases of rapid flow, which can occur in anomalously large fractures, in karst systems, or in zones of strong hydraulic gradient, for example, near active pumping wells and other unique situations. In multi-fluid systems, there's a wetting phase that preferentially coats the solid surfaces and occupies the smaller pore spaces, and a non-wetting phase that occupies the larger pore spaces. Non-aqueous phase liquids, or NAPLs, often are the non-wetting phase in the presence of water. However, over time, some non-aqueous phase liquids can become the wetting phase in some rock types. The density of non-aqueous phase liquids can strongly affect how deep they go within the subsurface, particularly in the saturated zone. In some cases, DNAPLs, which are denser than water, have gone to significant depths in saturated fractured rock formation. For the rest of our discussion about hydrology of fractured rock, we'll consider the concept of scale. This graphic is figure 3-1 from the guidance, and it illustrates the general range of scale where you might evaluate specific fracture characteristics, hydraulic properties, flow mechanisms or transport mechanisms. The next three slides look at three broad classifications of scale in a little bit more detail. These scales, from largest to smallest, are macroscopic, mesoscopic, and microscopic. As Jeff described in the previous section, it's often helpful to start with the big picture at a regional scale and work inward toward the scale of your site of interest. At this scale, we consider big features that may affect groundwater flow in the region around a site or across the site as a whole. We're interested in faults or linear features known as lineaments that could represent faults or fracture zones. We gather information about the locations and elevations of surface water features and general rock types. This information can be obtained from regional geologic and topographic maps, Google Earth, and similar resources. Remote sensing methods, including aerial photography and satellite imagery, are also useful. At the regional scale, we can also look for features that may indicate karst terrains, things like sinkholes, disappearing streams, springs, in carbonate formations. Based on this regional information, we get a general sense of whether regional structures may cut across a given site, the predominant orientations of regional structures, and the likely general directions of groundwater flow at the site. The intermediate or mesoscopic scale is where we learn the most regarding a given site. We collect the majority of our data at this scale, which matches the scale of the chemical plumes we evaluate and may need to remediate. We measure fracture orientation data in boreholes and at outcrops and analyze the data to identify the predominant fracture orientation, which strongly affect fluid flow directions. Hydraulic tests are used to evaluate the hydraulic properties of the bedrock, evaluate hydraulic connections between wells, and can also be used to estimate fracture apertures. As described in the guidance document, many tools are available for fracture analysis and hydraulic testing, and we'll go into that in more detail later in this training. Now let's bring up the next poll question. Which of these is a general representative range of in-situ fracture apertures in the upper few hundred feet of rock, or say the upper 100 meters or so of rock? Now these numbers are in millimeters. Interesting seeing the boats come in. And overall, the answer we're looking for is B, or the second one, I should say, which is 0.05 to 0.5 millimeters. This is equal to 50 to 500 micrometers, or microns. To put this in perspective, 0.1 millimeters is equal to 100 microns, and that's the thickness of one sheet of office paper. So most fractures in the subsurface have tiny apertures. However, they have very high hydraulic conductivity, and collectively, they represent the dominant fluid flow paths in bedrock. This is a good segue to the microscopic scale. And we can discontinue this poll question at this point. As indicated at the bottom of this slide, most of the data we collect in characterizing fractured rock is larger scale than this. But some small scale concepts and data types are worth keeping in mind. When inspecting bedrock core samples in the field, for example, Remember to look for signs of weathering or staining along fractures, which may indicate preferential flow zones for groundwater. Also look for fine-grained infilling within fractures, which may look like it's sort of clogging the fractures, and that may indicate that those fractures actually are clogged in situ. A microscopic scale is also where matrix diffusion occurs, right at the interface between a fracture and the matrix. It's often useful to submit core samples to a laboratory to measure the matrix parameters that can significantly affect the fate and transport of contaminant plumes in bedrock. So we started this section thinking about three main questions. Where is the fluid? Are there multiple phases? And how does it move? After we characterize the physical properties of the rock and the fluid properties that affect fluid flow, we can add this information to our CSM. The next step is to consider how this information helps us understand the fate and transport of chemicals. And at this point, I will turn the presentation over to Ted Tyler of Kleinfelder to discuss fate and transport.
Thank you, Michael. So we've talked about rock architecture. We've talked about the flow within fractured rock. And now what we're concerned with is the fate and transport. That is contaminants that have migrated down to fractured rock. And depending on the unique properties of the contaminants and the characteristics of the rock, the fate and transport mechanisms that play out will be determined. And some of those could be density-driven vertical migration. LNAPLs or DNAPLs that either float or sink in groundwater, dissolution and advection into the water in the fractures, matrix diffusion, so your dissolved component might partition into the matrix porosity. Subsequent over time might back diffuse from that rock porosity. Sorption and retardation being another, depending on the level of organics in the fractures or rock porosity, and degradation, depending on the mineralogy that's present in the microbes. You may have abiotic or biotic transformation. Focusing in on a couple of these in the graphics to the right, the top graphic shows in the case of a crystalline rock with no appreciable matrix porosity that a contaminant moving through the fracture is largely unretarded and not slowed down because of any transport into or diffusion into the rock matrix. Whereas in the second graphic, you now have, say, a sedimentary rock with more appreciable rock porosity. And so there is a part of that mass that is diffusing into that rock porosity and ultimately slowing down the advance of the contamination. And in the third scenario on the very bottom, still a sedimentary rock, but in this case, perhaps a higher level of organic matter in the fractures or rock porosity, and so you have an additional slowing and retardation of that advance for the contamination. Focusing in on the unique properties of contaminants and ultimately on the next slides getting into chemical mixtures. For example, looking at TCE, we might look at properties such as shown here, liquid density, which of course is going to tell us whether it's going to float or sink in the water, vapor pressure, which is going to inform us as to the level of volatilization that might be present, solubility, which will inform us regarding a dissolved plume that may be present, Henry's constant, which can tell us whether or not off-gassing will occur from the groundwater to the vadose zone, and KOC is an indication of the degree of retardation depending on the degree of organic matter in the fractures and rock porosity. And these particular properties then would govern the fate and transport mechanisms that would be at play. And what you can do is you can color code the particular properties to highlight fate and transport mechanisms that may be most at play. And for example, here for TCE, you know, the light blue is highlighted showing that this is a dense chemical and likely to sink in groundwater. The green for both vapor pressure and Henry's constant, suggesting that we would have both volatilization into the unsaturated zone as well as off-gassing from the groundwater. and the solubility highlighted in purple to indicate that this is a chemical where we're likely to have a dissolved plume present, and KOC highlighted in brown indicating that retardation is likely, and then finally, in this case, red for reactivity for abiotic biochemical transformation, suggesting that if the correct mineralogy is present, we may have that mechanism at play in terms of the fate and transport of the contaminant. And if you have multiple contaminants at your site, you can create a table of all of them, and some of them may or may not have colors depending on whether or not they're significant in terms of the fate and transport. Looking at chemical mixtures, for example, a Dean apple, you know, the bullets on the left kind of outline some of the fate and transport mechanisms sort of in order, and then are shown in the graphics on the right. So say for a Dean apple in the initial release, in a sedimentary bedrock, it will migrate downward through the fractures. But at this early time, there's no appreciable dissolved phase plume or otherwise. Whereas over time, as the constituents of the Dean apple do dissolve, then you have a more appreciable dissolved plume as well as diffusion into the rock matrix in the case of a sedimentary rock, presenting an intermediate time graphic in the center. And then on the bottom graphic on the lower right is over the long term, after the Dean apple is no longer present, perhaps the high concentration dissolved has dissipated, and what you have remaining is a reservoir of in this case, Dean apple mass or the constituents that have dissolved held up in the rock matrix that are slowly back diffusing into the groundwater, potentially sustaining levels above cleanup levels at your site. Continuing with contaminant mixtures, in this case elm apple and their particular fate and transport in fractured rock, and first revisiting the notions of strike and dip. If you look at the graphic on the upper right, dip being the angle of the fracture relative to the horizontal plane, strike being the orientation of the fracture as expressed in the horizontal plane. So for a Dean apple entering a fracture, its fate and transport is likely to be such that it will migrate downward along the dip in the unsaturated zone. However, as it encounters groundwater, it's likely to move across the strike as opposed to the dip. Now, some of the implications of this in the second bullet, 4-inch, as shown in the graphic on the lower right, are that you end up with a very discrete line of where the elm apple is. And so you can see that wells placed, can easily miss the elm apple. And so it's important probably in this kind of scenario to consider triangulation. If you understand the angle of the dip and you understand where groundwater is, you can triangulate and perhaps pinpoint it, but it's challenging. If the elm apple is encountered in a horizontal fracture, the fade and transport, the last thing I'd point out here, is largely going to be driven by hydraulic gradient as opposed to other factors. Looking at Dean apple now as opposed to elm apple, same concept of strike and dip. In this case, similarly, the Dean apple will flow down the dip in the unsaturated zone until it encounters groundwater, but being more dense will sink. And if there's enough mass and the fracture terminates, as shown in the graphic on the lower right, that mass can then migrate along the strike of the fracture at the base. Now, the implications here for investigation are that shallow wells away from the release point are very likely to miss both the Dean apple as well as higher concentration dissolved. And however, as the dip of the fracture fluctuates, you might get a greater footprint of the dissolved phase plume, which might actually improve your chances of at least seeing something in your investigation. And as with elm apple, the Dean apple in a horizontal fracture is going to be largely influenced by hydraulic gradient more than anything else. For those that are familiar with the IDSS document, the Integrated Dean Apple Site Strategy document developed by ITRC a few years back, a 14-compartment model was presented as developed by Chuck Newell and Tom Sale. In this current guidance document for fractured rock, we have an adaptation of that 14 compartment model that we call the 21 compartment model, which is an adaptation for the use in fractured rock. And the model is shown here basically on the top row, includes, is divided according to the source zone and then down gradient extent. Those two zones are then further subdivided according to relative transmissivity, such as matrix storage, this is the rock porosity, matrix flow, in the case of an uncemented sandstone, we have actual flow through the rock, and fracture flow, the secondary porosity component of the transmissivity, both in the source zone and down gradient extent. And on the column on the far left, you have the various phases of the contaminant that may be present. And as you complete this table, as I'll show in the next couple of slides, what you have is a quick snapshot of the CSM. This is not a replacement for the CSM, but it's a quick snapshot of the CSM at a level of resolution that can be used to communicate and make high-level decisions such as characterization remediation objectives, as well as screening technologies and the like. So in the first scenario here that I'll present, you have a DNAPL release into fractured rock, and in this case, it's an uncemented sandstone. So with regard to the uncemented sandstone, we have all compartments represented in terms of transmissivity, matrix storage, matrix flow, and fracture flow. So the colors shown here, orange being the higher relative concentration, yellow being moderate or medium level concentrations, and green being relatively low concentrations, suggest that what's shown here is perhaps an intermediate phase plume or an intermediate time period where you still have DNAPL present in the fractures, as shown in the orange, that has begun to partition into the dissolved and sorbed phase and vapor phase, as shown in yellow in the source zone under fracture flow, and then subsequently diffused into the matrix storage as well as there's some matrix flow. Now this, the dissolved phase in the source zone has subsequently moved down gradient through fractures and is expressed as yellow in the down gradient extent area and subsequently partitioned. Now as you change as you change the rock type to a shale bedrock, all other things being the same, the first thing that is evident is you know the compartments begin to reduce. With the shale bedrock as opposed to an uncemented sandstone, you no longer have the matrix flow component. You still have matrix storage, you still have fracture flow, and so the fade and transport is shown here similarly with an intermediate phase release where you have DNAPL still present in the fractures, partitioning to the dissolved, sorbed, and vapor phase, some degree of matrix storage, and that mass migrating via advection down gradient and subsequently partitioning as shown. Now in the case of a crystalline rock such as a granite, right off the bat, you see the 21 compartment model even further simplifies as you no longer have an appreciable matrix storage. You no longer have matrix flow. You primarily have fracture flow. So your concentrations for this, again, intermediate phase release still show a DNAPL presence in the fractures, partitioned to the dissolved, sorbed, and vapor phase, and moving down gradient, and then subsequently partitioning. But a much simpler presentation of the model for a crystalline rock is typical. Now with this slide, the next speaker is going to talk about development of the formal CSM. And again, the 21 compartment model is not a replacement for that, but a snapshot of it at a level of resolution for making high-level decisions. While I want to show that there's a high level of detail potentially in the CSM, I don't intend to go over all the details so much as to point out that there is a lot of detail. And if you superimpose a 21 compartment model onto that, you can, for communication purposes, for high-level decision-making purposes, get a quick snapshot of where the mass is and perhaps begin to make decisions with regard to characterization, remediation objectives, and ultimately screening technologies and so on and so forth, as other speakers will be talking about later on. With that, that's the end of the fate and transport section. I believe we have question and answers.
Thanks, Ted. We do have time now for questions, and everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A in the bottom right. If you're in the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and you're welcome now to jump in with a question you can ask out loud. I'll remind you also, in our related links, the last item we list, you may need to scroll down to see it, is the link to our feedback form. We do look for everyone on the call to complete the feedback before we wrap up today. So if you select feedback, look down a bit, select browse to, that's going to allow that feedback form to open in a new window. The feedback is also your opportunity to create a certificate for participating today. So if you'd like a certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit the feedback, the system's going to generate the certificate for you. So right now, the only way to do that is by filling out the feedback form. A couple questions have come in. When you reference DNAPL in this presentation and in the 21 compartment model, are you referring to free phase DNAPL, residual DNAPL, or both?
I'm referring to the DNAPL that has been released that has not dissolved, as to whether that includes residual and free phase. I would say mostly I'm looking at free phase.
Could you jump in, Ted? I think in maybe a sandstone, you might get to residual phase, and you may have little small pools of NAPL, rough spots in the fracture that you could equate to residual phase. But really, it's primarily, I agree with you, it's primarily just the free phase NAPL. You don't really have the cutoffs with little ganglia can form in a fracture space.
Our next question refers to slides 45 and 46, so I'll go back to that. Why is there fracture flow in source zone but not in downgradient extent?
Which slide are we talking about? 46?
45 and 46. There, so we're looking
yeah,
at 46.
There is fracture flow in the source zone, and there's also the model is intended to show that there is fracture flow in the down gradient extent. So there
the NA is kind of there because the NAPL is the source zone. You could get some down gradient, but we're still kind of considering NAPL as a source when you do this model, so that's why we have not really a down gradient.
Screen length in fractured rock would seem to be greatly affected the dissolved concentrations measured. Can you speak to this?
Can you repeat the question, Juliana, please?
Screen length in fractured rock would seem to greatly affect the dissolved concentrations measured. Can you speak to this?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is, one of the things we stress in this document is you don't want to make things worse by having an open hole with a very large screen where you have fractures interconnecting. Because it's been shown, Beth Parker shown this and some other people, that you may have a clean fracture which becomes dirty because the higher head in the dirty fracture will flow into the clean fracture. So you really want to be careful when you're completing your well. You don't leave it open. You probably shouldn't have long screen lengths. Because, again, unless all your fractures are the same, they're all interconnected, which is not always the case, you really don't want to have connections. You don't want to make things worse. So screen length, yes, definitely could cause dilution, but if you're actually doing this correctly and having small intervals where you're collecting your samples from, it won't be as much of an issue.
Thank you.
I have a question for the folks there with regards to, in particular, sedimentary type bedrock where you may have layers, if you will, that pinch out. So, for example, you may have non-continuous zones of sandstone or weathered sandstone that dead into, let's say, a siltstone or shale. And it's possible that the fluid then, you know, in a way can get trapped. The contamination may get trapped or pooled in that dead-end zone. Have you guys run into that?
I think that's what we see basically in both fractured rock and just sedimentary rock and just in unconsolidated materials. Yeah, there's a lot of heterogeneity. If you have a zone where you can see the same thing with just fractures themselves, you have material build up in a fracture and not be able to move because it's a dead-end fracture, we definitely can see that. And if you are having an area pinch out, like you're a cyclothymical depositional pattern where you have a variety of rock types, you definitely can get dead end locations, absolutely. But I think it's less than what you might think, as there is generally some flow, usually somewhere, because the fractures actually increase the flow.
How do you actually determine the orientation and dip of the fractures on your site? Is it mainly using oriented cores?
That's a really good question.
Michael, this is John. Do you want me to address that?
Yeah, go please, yes.
Okay. I think the best way to do that is to use optical televiewer and acoustic televiewer, downhole borehole geophysical tools. Oriented core is, that's an option, but in my experience, the borehole geophysical tools are a very effective way to do that. What you need to be careful about is that the contractor that's doing the work for you understands how to correct the data for borehole tilt and magnetic declination so that the orientation data that you end up with is corrected to true north. In other words, you collect the optical televiewer and the acoustic televiewer. That's a kind of raw data, if you will, and then you need someone, borehole geophysicist, to look at those logs and actually identify the features in those logs. That feature information, then it's called a structure log, then needs to be corrected for borehole tilt and corrected to for magnetic declination, and that gives you the orientation data for the features.
That really underscores the need to have a team when you work on the site. And I've also go back from a higher level point of view, is get out in the field and measure them. And this thing I mentioned in Southern Vermont, where all these houses are contaminated with PFAS, we've been mapping the geology for about 2 years now and have a very good idea of where the fractures are in the regional geology, that where we're going to find faults, where we're going to find brittle structures. So it's a mixture of in the borehole, that's where you get your most information, but also, you know, get your aerial photos out, look for liminates. Use LIDAR, and get out in the field, walk around with your button compass.
Yeah, Michael, that's a good...
That when it's covered over with glacial deposits or you don't have the benefit of bedrock outcroppings.
Well, yeah, we're very familiar with that in Vermont and a lot of places. But then you have to go down more to geophysics and like John was talking about, the downhole tools.
I just wanted to reinforce your point that start with existing published sources. You can very often get basic information on orientation from that and then go from there.
All the data you can is what is important. The more data you have, the better chance you have, because it is more difficult. But I mean, there are data that can help you.
How important are microscopic fractures? Could these still contribute largely to the overall understanding of connectivity / flow?
I mean, my own experience is more of the microfractures being storage zones. Not a lot of flow from them, but they are storage zones where your NAPL or your contaminants can sit, because they aren't part of the major flow.
A follow-up question to our discussion on the screening length. So Michael said that shorter is better because you don't make things worse. So our commenter says, true. However, there is a larger opportunity to miss the contamination if measuring from a particularly short screen.
Yeah, that's because that's why you characterize the hole, what John was talking about. You go down in the hole, you find out what the fractures are. And then you can set up these packer or the flute liners, ways like that. There are ways to do discrete interval samples in the hole itself. If you have multiple fractures, if you can do it, you need to take samples from each fracture so you understand what's going on. And we definitely have, like in this area I was talking about, we have some wells, so all dirty with one well in the center completely clean with no PFAS at all, just because it's a little deeper, it has a different fracture, older water. So, I mean, you have to understand your fracture. You can't just put a screen in and put a well in and think that's going to tell you what you have to do. Because that well is your location for good data, so you have to go in there and actually characterize the well and look at the fractures.
Thank you. Thanks for interacting. I'm sorry. Do you have more, Michael?
I was going to say, it does cost more, but this is your only location, so or maybe one of your few locations. So spend the money where it's going to do the most good.
Thank you. Thanks to our audience also for interacting. We're going to wrap up this question and answer break. So if you did take your phone off mute, be sure you've either muted at your location or it's *6 to mute in our phone system. Everyone is welcome to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to continue to enter in questions. We'll get to as many as we can during the second question and answer break of today's training. If you do leave before we wrap up, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. It's your opportunity also to get a certificate for attending today's class. So be sure, if you're interested in a certificate, to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Even if you're not interested in the certificate, we do appreciate it if you take just a few minutes to give us your feedback at the end of the training class. We'll continue on now with the second half of the training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Ryan Wymore at CDM Smith. Ryan?
All right. Thanks, Juliana. So just a bit of a recap, kind of a roadmap for what we've covered already and what we're going to be moving into. We spent the first part of the training going over kind of the basics, similarities and differences between fractured rock sites and unconsolidated media sites. This next part of the training, we're going to talk a little bit more about the process of creating and updating the conceptual site model. So that's represented by Chapter 5. Once I'm done, Dan is going to talk about remedial action objectives, as well as selecting remedies and considerations for remediation at fractured rock sites, and then John is going to talk about monitoring. So in developing a fractured rock CSM, we want to point out that we're not presenting a start-to-finish cookbook or a step-by-step procedure for building a conceptual site model at a fractured rock site. Instead, we're highlighting key elements that are unique to fractured rock sites or maybe important considerations that you need to emphasize when you're working on a fractured rock site. So you see this flowchart on the right of the slide. This was actually developed in a previous ITRC team a couple of years ago, the integrated site characterization process that was part of the DNAPL characterization document that came out in 2015. So this is still the framework that we're working within for this process. So our document references this flowchart, and we've reproduced it here. So that's another reason why I'm not going to go into great detail on all of these steps. But at a high level, the first part of the flowchart deals with a planning phase. We have a tool selection phase and then an implementation phase where you conduct the investigation or perform the field activities and then generate the data. So this is the framework that we're working within. So this slide 51 shows how this training kind of maps back to the document. So section 5.1, we talk about this iterative approach to a conceptual site model. And then once you have identified the need to go out and collect more data, We describe how to define a problem statement, how to enumerate data gaps, as well as the resolution that you need to understand your site. And then we talk about data quality objectives. We'll get to tools and then talk about data interpretation. So we have a poll question here. Juliana, if you could bring that up. So this is a little bit kind of a learning check just to make sure that you haven't completely forgotten the stuff that we talked about before the Q&A period. But so this is kind of back to Mike's section. So which of the following representative range of fracture porosities represent the total rock volume that is composed of fractures? All right, responses coming in. It looks like most are selecting the top, which is the correct answer. So this was kind of mentioned earlier that, you know, even though fractures really hydraulically control, if you're just doing, you know, looking at the amount of pore space represented by the fractures compared to the whole volume of the aquifer, it is still really small. Okay, let's go back to our slide. So what we're showing here is kind of a zoomed-in version of what we emphasize in this document about characterizing fractured rock sites. So we start off with an initial characterization objective, and this can be something big picture. So I have an example of this on the next slide just to kind of bring the point home. So after the characterization objectives are established, we look at our site and say, you know, how are we going to resolve, what are the data gaps and how are we going to resolve them? So we get to specific characterization objectives. What do we need to fill those data gaps? And that leads us to the tools table. That's the how do you get there. So specifically, how do you collect the data that you need to fill your data gaps? One concept that we put forth in this document is this idea of a significant data gap. So we didn't want to only stick to kind of the conventional open to interpretation definition of significant. One of the members of our team actually brought this to our group that some guidance from his state has a specific definition for significant. And so that's shown here. And the gist of it is that you have missing or incomplete information, which limits the formulation of interpreting the data at the site. That's the gist of it. Another way to say it is, based on the data that you currently have, could you have more than one conceptual model? So based on the data that exists for your site, maybe could there be two different release scenarios or two different source areas? You're not sure which one is the right one, or maybe two different flow directions, or whatever it is, that the data that you have could support more than one CSM. If that's the case, then you have what we would call a significant data gap. And the reason that that's important is, especially at fractured rock sites, there are always going to be things that you don't know or that you wish you had more information about, or you wish you had more sampling points or more hydraulic data or whatever it may be. So the idea is, do you know enough about your site to form the CSM? So this is a reference down at the bottom to this language about significant data gaps from the state of Connecticut. So here's the example that I was mentioning for the kind of the steps on the last slide. So let's say the characterization objective at this big picture level is to determine the lateral and vertical extent of dissolved phase VOCs. Okay, that's pretty generic. So obviously the data gap then is that you don't know the extent, you know, vertically and laterally of the VOCs. So your data collection objective, now you're getting more specific and you're turning this into a statement that you then can use to select tools, which is the next step in the process. So maybe your data collection objective is, in areas beneath the source and between the source and the receptor, gather data on fracture locations, fracture orientation, and VOC concentrations. So you can already get a sense for the kind of field activities that you might perform to fill those data gaps. So that leads us to the next part of the process. This was the central step in that flowchart that I showed, is the tools matrix. So this is a separate downloadable Excel spreadsheet that you can get from the Fractured Rock Documents homepage. So it's a file that you download and use separately from the online guidance. And it's a collection of lots and lots of tools. So I've got some screenshots to kind of show what this looks like on the next few slides. So it really is oriented just like a table. So down the side in rows, each row has a different tool in it, and they're categorized because if you look at the whole thing in its entirety, it's really kind of unwieldy because it has well over 100 tools that populate it. So you can sort by characterization objective. So for purposes of our table, we divided that into geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry. So obviously, you can kind of infer what types of data that you would fit into each of those categories. We have effectiveness in media, so unconsolidated versus bedrock, unsaturated versus saturated. So you can sort, maybe you only want something that returns data about the vadose zone. And then we talk about data quality. So in this case, what we mean is whether it is a quantitative result, a semi-quantitative result, or qualitative result. So a quantitative result, we would say, is something like a concentration or maybe, you know, a transmissivity, something that is a quantified, you know, mass per volume or length per time or whatever it is. The semi-quantitative refers to things like maybe passive soil vapor samplers where you get a number, but it's not necessarily a direct measurement of a concentration. And then qualitative might be things like a membrane interface probe or something where you get responses and you generate profiles, but it's not a direct reading of a subsurface property. So one note, one point I want to make is you might be noticing this point, unconsolidated versus bedrock. We do have tools in this matrix that don't work in bedrock. So for example, we have populated in here some of the direct push tools and those sorts of things. A couple of reasons for that. One is that this matrix, if I didn't mention it earlier, it's based on but also separate from a matrix that we did for the DNAPL integrated site characterization document. So we took that and enhanced it and added to it. But the other reason is that, you know, again, we're talking about building a conceptual site model for your whole site, and it's not uncommon to have a component of overburden along with the bedrock at one of these sites. So we didn't want to just omit those, especially since we already had a lot of information developed for some of those tools. But if you really are just interested in the bedrock, all you have to do is just click on that search box and you'll just get bedrock tools. So here's a screenshot of part of the tools matrix. You can click on any box to get more information. So here we have the definition of geology. I don't know that it's comprehensive or definitive, but it's at least how we're defining geology for this, you know, for purposes of our table. You can also click on any individual tool. So let's say we want to find more about ground penetrating radar, and you get more information that comes up for that tool. You get a description, you get applicability, which is basically like pros and cons because you get limitations as well. And then you get these citations. So in some cases, these are just links to the citation for journal papers, for example. In cases where there are publicly available reports or documents, we tried to link to those actual documents. So for example, here this, you know, EPA documents publicly available. So to the extent that we could actually provide links to the actual documents we did. So this is kind of how it looks when you want to find information about a tool. And then let's say you make your set of selections in those various categories that I mentioned. Then you hit the search button and it returns a subset of the information in the tools matrix. And again, we're doing that just because this thing is, it's really too big to look at the whole thing at once. So you can down select based on the specific items that you're interested in. And then when you do that, if you have a green shading in a box, then that means that the tool provides that kind of data. So that's how this thing works. All right, so moving on from the tools matrix, this might seem like I'm skipping ahead in the process a little bit, but I want to touch on data presentation and interpretation. And the reason I'm doing this now will become clear here in a couple of slides. So when you're thinking about going out to the field, you want to consider what you're going to do with the data once you complete your field activities. And again, in the interest of presenting what can be unique at fractured rock sites, this is one of the, to me, one of the bigger differences that can be present when you're characterizing fractured rock sites, because you don't perform this kind of, you know, logging, acoustic logging, geophysical logging at unconsolidated sites. So one way to present these kind of data are these integrated borehole logs, and it is just what it sounds like. You're basically tying together and integrating all the different types of data you collect for a single borehole on one figure. So here we have optical and acoustic televiewer. We have some geophysical logs. We have caliper logs here. If you do flow logging, like heat pulse flow metering, you can post those data on here. You can put contaminant concentrations. So here we're showing TCE collected at specific depth discrete intervals, presumably placed, you know, near fractures, because you're trying to see what contaminant concentrations are present at different depths. So these are a way to put everything together. We also have skipped over the fracture, some information about the fractures as well on here. So you can put it all together on one figure. And again, we wanted to include an example of this because this is one of the things that's different at fractured rock sites that maybe some haven't seen before, but these are really powerful because they pull a lot of information together in one place. So this is one way to look at the data, and again, this is just for a single borehole log, or for a single borehole, but one reason I want to put it here is because you want to think about this. If you're in the planning phase and you're going to go out and collect some of these data, do you want to use this approach? A couple of other data presentation, interpretation, techniques are a lot more familiar and common. So here we're showing a potentiometric surface. This is a large-scale map, and of course this is what we do for unconsolidated sites as well. We put this in the document just to show that you construct these as well for fractured rock sites. The same for cross-sections. You still can build cross-sections, assuming you have enough data to do it, and you can map, you know, you can post contaminant concentrations, you can try to map features. Obviously, here you may be talking about fractures or different types of bedrock zones or whatnot. So you still can generate cross-sections at these sites. And one thing to emphasize, you see down at the bottom, and I didn't mention this on the borehole log figure, but these are in the document, and they're more fully described in the document, what these are and how they can be helpful in data interpretation. All right, so now we're back to the ISC process. So now we're in the middle of this flowchart where we have set our objectives and we've selected tools. Now we're going to actually develop the work plan. So we're not quite in the field yet. So just for example, let's say that the activities at your site are going to be to drill some bedrock boreholes, collect some rock cores, you know, do some hydraulic testing, and then do some sampling. When you build the work plan, much like you do for other sites, you want to emphasize the objectives, present the process you're going to use to collect data, include and describe the tools, and then be forward-looking to what you're going to do with the data when you get it. So that's why we talked about the data interpretation first, as opposed to at the end, because you don't want to go out and collect a bunch of data and then not be ready to handle it or not have the software that you need to generate logs you want, for example. You also want to talk about the data evaluation process, how you're going to look at the data. So historically, in past documents that we've come out with over the past decade, I would say at least, ITRC endorses a dynamic approach to site characterization. So this involves, to the extent that you can do it, real-time data assessment, very frequent communication between the team, basically to evaluate data and decide what to do next. We put this slide in here because it's not impossible to do the same approach at a fractured rock site. Now, it might not look the same because you're not going to be using, you know, a direct push kind of tooling to generate all your data in the field, but you still can have components of this where you look at logs as they're generated in real time. You can obviously still have mobile labs at these sites. So you can still have elements of this dynamic approach where you're evaluating data as they come in to decide what to do next. And all of this should be documented, the process for doing this, in the work plan. So next is when you go out and actually implement the site investigation. So again, you can be evaluating results as they come in. And a point that was made earlier that Michael mentioned that we stress here is that the characterization activities must be designed not to spread contamination. So you don't want to drill a long borehole and leave it open for months to years because you're going to completely redistribute contamination. You're going to connect different zones that maybe weren't hydraulically connected before. In addition to just, you know, to spreading contamination, you can also really confound your data interpretation in terms of the contaminant distribution. So we want to stress this point, and this needs to be made in the work plan because, again, you need to account for how you're going to handle the boreholes once you drill them. Okay, so that kind of wraps up the process part of this in terms of building and enhancing the CSM. The next few slides, we have a case study that I'm going to introduce up to a point in this section, and it's going to be picked up in a later section when we're talking about remediation. So this brief case study is going to illustrate the few points that are shown on this slide, how we start with the regional approach and how that influences the site scale. We're going to recognize the usefulness of the fracture data. So the question that was asked earlier is very timely because we talk about that here. We're going to look at how the fracture orientation affects trying to model at one of these sites and also the plume geometry and the evolution of a plume. And then we'll show for this site what ended up being the hydraulic fate and transport parameters that were used. So this is the Solvents Recovery Service of New England Superfund site. So on this figure, we show a geologic cross-section at the top and then a plan view geologic map at the bottom. So for this site, I'm going to zoom in here. So the site's down here if you can't see it. So what we have, these red units are igneous rocks that are intruded between layers of sedimentary rocks. So this is kind of the reason we're showing this is, again, in keeping with the approach we mentioned earlier, you want to start at the regional scale. So back to the terrain analysis section, this is going to give us the overall context for the site. So that's why this is important, because we understand now what we're dealing with as we start to get to the site scale. So this slide shows the patterns of the fractures in more detail. This was based on logging that was done at the site, which I'll get to in a minute, but also data collection from outcrops that were present at the site. So as shown here, the main fracture sets consist of bedding plane fractures that dip gently toward the east-southeast. So that's these fractures. But notice we depict some perpendicular cross-cutting fractures here that certainly could be important when thinking of contaminant transport at these kind of sites. So this next slide shows the in-situ fracture orientation data. So in this case, as I mentioned, there was a lot of downhole logging that was done using a digital optical televiewer at this site. So this slide just shows different ways to visualize those data. So this top figure is the dip vectors in a stereo net. So basically what you can see from this is that most of them are oriented toward the east-southeast. We also show down at the lower left a different way of visualizing the data. Kind of the same thing, showing the primary fracture sets are oriented toward the east-southeast. And then this last one shows the dip angle that shows they're just below horizontal. And that was kind of depicted on the last slide as well. So looking at the hydraulics at this site, this shows essentially the potentiometric surface out here. We have, let's see, get my arrow back, here we go. So essentially we have a river at this site, and the potentiometric surface is basically toward the river, which of course is not surprising. We're depicting the site itself here, so we've got these red arrows showing where the water would be flowing through the site toward the river. One thing to point out on this, that the way these slides are oriented, north is to the right. All right, so slide 71, what we see when actually looking at the data is that the plume did not go toward the river, which I guess is a good thing. But what was happening is the plume was moving this way, which again is to the south on this figure. Completely different direction than what the gradient would suggest. So obviously you have to start digging into this and thinking, well, okay, why is this happening? So we can obviously tell that there is some strong anisotropy at this site in the horizontal plane. And the main reason is because there's a single fracture set that is oriented in a way that controls the flow that basically makes it go this direction. So this is a classic case of at fractured rock sites, you can't just look at the gradient because you have to understand the structure of the rock because that's going to control where the flow goes. So in terms of trying to model this site, the project team was actually able to match water levels. So they were able to reproduce what was being seen in the field from that perspective, but it wasn't until this very significant anisotropy term was included in the model that they could actually reproduce the plume geometry in the way that was seen in the field. So slide 72, this is a little bit of a different way to look at the site, but this is a 3D EVS, so one of the 3D visualization modeling tools that are available. This is a view that shows the seven direct hits of Dean Apple in the bedrock. So you can see where the top of bedrock is up at the top of the figure. So realizing that the details of the fracture system here are pretty complex, but in general what this shows is that the direct hits of NAPL align with the average fracture orientation. So that's the point of this, is that the DNAPL, you know, the migration of the DNAPL was controlled by the fractures at this site. But then it begs the question, well, okay, how deep does this go? Are we going to have, you know, are we going to be chasing this problem, you know, way down deep into the bedrock? So one of the other things that was done at this site was to look at the mean fracture aperture with depth. So that's shown on slide 73. And I guess from the perspective of you know, how deep the contaminants go, what this showed is that the deeper you get, the smaller the fractures get. So practically speaking, there's a limit, thankfully, to how deep the contamination and how deep the DNAPL could go at this site. So slide 74, this is a summary of all of the properties that were used for the fate and transport evaluation and the modeling at this site. So kind of a cool photo here is one of the outcrops at the site. For purposes of scale, this is a gentleman well over 6 feet tall for purposes of scale at this outcrop. But this was one of the ways that data was generated and these fractures were characterized at the site was looking at outcrops like this. But you can see the properties that were used. Notice that since this is a sedimentary rock site, the matrix porosity, you know, is not insignificant, way higher than the fracture porosity for sure. But again, this is what was used for the fate and transport evaluation at this site. All right, so keep that site in mind. It's going to come up again, but that wraps up the conceptual site model section. Now I'm going to turn it over to Dan to talk about remediation.
Thank you, Ryan, and welcome everybody. So moving on to the next section, section 6 of the document, talks about remedial action objectives and selecting remedies for your site. So up to this point, Jeff and Mike have talked a lot about the geology and hydrology of bedrock sites. Ted talked about fate and transport. Ryan introduced conceptual site models. So we know what's there. We know where it's at. We know where it's going. What are we going to do about it? That's what the focus of Chapter 6 is about. So moving on to slide 76. One of the key points about Bedrock is that attaining prescriptive levels like MCLs can generally be more challenging in rock than it is in overburden. That doesn't minimize how difficult it can be in overburden, but it tends to be, in general, an additional order of magnitude more difficult in bedrock environments. And for that reason, what we would really like to recommend is that we focus on SMART remedial action objectives. And SMART is an acronym that's already been introduced. It's explained again down here in the lower right-hand corner. The acronym is explained down here in the lower right-hand corner. And consider remedies in particular that have very reasonable, and I use reasonable in quotes, but reasonable time frames and costs that would address the most critical risks and foster partial cleanups and address community concerns. And bottom line, make progress toward complete restoration. So start small, aim for the ultimate objective, but recognize that you're not going to address all of this and get a site all the way to the end in sort of one fell swoop, particularly at a bedrock site. Moving on to slide 77, let's talk a little bit more about establishing those remedial action objectives. So this slide has some examples of what we may consider SMART remedial action objectives with the goal of risk reduction. So you might think about, for example, groundwater recharge to surface water as one goal, or identifying those locations and addressing that as a remedial action objective. Vapor discharge, if you have a building over top a concentrated VOC plume, for example, developing your remedial action objectives to address that. Or mass flux, if you have a large plume. A lot of times we find that very small intervals within your overall site are controlling in terms of your off-site distribution of VOCs. And targeting source zones might be another action objective. But with all of these cases, it's very important to acknowledge your uncertainty and develop contingency plans, because things will change as you progress with particularly with a bedrock site. Moving on to slide 78, this table is intended to summarize some special considerations in bedrock, particularly compared to overburden type situations. And these first three really address fluid issues. For example, the first one, hydraulic connectivity and mass storage, you have a much wider range of those domains in fractured rock, for example, compared to overburden. And that's going to be important as you develop your remedies, because that's going to very strongly affect your injection and extraction designs, basically, depending upon the type of scenario you have. Same thing can be said with NAPL and groundwater flow or direction and flux. All of this is going to be controlled by fractures and their distribution, which can be a very different type of scenario than what we deal with typically in a granular overburden. And then also with particular respect to remediation, biotic and abiotic reactions can be very different in rock than in overburden. And we'll touch more about this in a moment. But one of the key differences is that the surface area that water moving through a fracture is exposed to, I should say the solid, the surface area of the solid that water moving through a fracture is exposed to, is far less in fractured rock than it is in overburden. In overburden, your water is permeating through the, you know, the individual granules, and so it gets exposed to a lot more overburden. And that affects many processes, both abiotic and biotic. Any type of water-rock interaction is going to be very different in fractured rock compared to overburden. So moving on to slide 79, let's talk a little bit about those rock types. And in a very general sense, rock type is a primary influence on remedy selection. And again, it's very general. Everything's going to change from site to site. But for example, when I say rock type, whether it's a granite or a limestone, all your characteristics of your site are going to be affected by those types of, or very general types of rock. For example, hydraulic characteristics, variations in organic carbon content, or those abiotic transformation reactions that I touched on before, all of that is going to be affected to a first degree by the general rock type. So that's an important place to begin. So if we move to slide 80, the next important sort of first order characteristic to consider is the contaminant that's present. If you have a very highly soluble contaminant, and again, it's on a relative scale with what we deal with in our industry, but relatively highly soluble contaminants can exhibit strong matrix diffusion. We often think that contaminants cannot penetrate into the rock, but in fact they can. And so the more soluble your contaminant is, the more likely it is to be able to diffuse into the rock. Second important factor, this was touched on earlier as well, the migration of NAPLs can be very different in fractured rock, and NAPL can be transported very great distances compared to, say, the typical overburden site because of those both horizontal and vertical components of transport in the fracture network. And then again, as I've already touched on a little bit, the water contaminant rock interactions can be very different in a fracture surface than in a rock matrix. For those contaminants that do penetrate into the rock, they'll be exposed to a different set of interactions, and they will get more of that surface area interaction than, say, contaminant or water simply moving through the fracture zone itself. Moving on to slide 81, please do not try to read this table. You're not intended to be able to read this table. This is table 6-2 from the document, and what we're going to do in the next couple of slides is sort of break out different sections of this to highlight how we developed it and how we hope you'd be able to use it. So if we go to slide 82, let me back up one. I'm going to go back one more slide. So this was set up in very general sense. We have rock types here on the left. We have some geological characteristics, very general geological characteristics that correlate with those rock types. And then we have the remedies. And so now I'll break it up a little bit more, and we'll start with those hydrogeological aspects. And these were selected in part to fit with the 21-compartment model that Ted introduced earlier in this training. So basically, for each of those major rock types, we evaluated types of transmissivity, whether it would be matrix flow predominantly or high matrix flow or high or low fracture flow. And in a very general sense, the amount of matrix storage that might be expected in the bedrock itself based on those general rock types. The next component of that table is the range of technologies. Now, in the next several slides, we'll talk a bit more about those technologies. But for now, just showing the ranges of technologies that were considered in this table, a number of different physical types of removal technologies, containment technologies, and chemical and biological remediation technologies. Next, moving to slide 84, for each of these individual types of technologies, in a very general sense, we evaluated whether or not they could be generally applicable or not generally applicable or unlikely applicable for each of these technologies as a function for each of these rock types. So you'll see a Y, meaning that this would be a generally applicable technology for a wide range of rock types, whereas thermal remediation in this case would be applicable to some, unapplicable to others. And again, very general sense. I want to emphasize these are all going to be very general, and there can be some site-specific characteristics that will affect the applicability of these technologies that, of course, have to be considered for your particular site. Moving on to slide 85, now we'll start talking about some of those individual technologies themselves. So let's start with physical technologies or physical removal technologies, beginning actually with removal. Believe it or not, there are situations where you can physically remove the rock. Now, of course, this is going to be generally limited to unsaturated or soft or weathered rock. There are actually some characteristics, rippability, or seismic velocity can be used as ways to evaluate whether or not you could actually do removal in a rock. And this can be very good, for example, at a site where you have high matrix storage or high primary porosity, and you could have NAPL in that material. So this could be a good option. Thermal methods. Now, thermal methods can certainly be applied to rock, but there's a very important differences in different types of thermal methods. For example, if you have thermal conductive heating versus electrical resistance heating, they have different types or different ranges of applicability in rock. That we go into a lot more detail in that in the document, but it's important to point that out, that not all thermal methods are alike, particularly with respect to rock. Air sparge, commonly applied. It's important to recognize that unlike a granular overburden, distribution is going to be controlled by those fractures. And so you're going to have, you know, preferred pathways right off the bat, which may or may not be a good thing. Again, it's a very site-specific consideration. Moving to slide 86, other types of physical technologies, in this case vapor or multiphase extraction, both commonly applied in bedrock. Their design can be a little bit more difficult in rock compared to overburden because of the heterogeneities and how fluids will move. And it's also important that to point out that these technologies are commonly coupled with other technologies. And coupling technologies is an important thing we'll talk a little bit more about a little bit more about later on. Moving to slide 87, another physical type of technology, in this case surfactant or co-solvent flushing. This can be really, really heterogeneous or really challenging due to heterogeneous fluid flow. And in fact, because of these challenges, in a 2003 document specifically on surfactant or co-solvent flushing, ITRC recommended against using this technology in fractured rock aquifers. If you do select it, make sure you have very, very good understanding of the hydrology of your site and of the capture of the material. Moving to slide 88. Pump and treat systems, probably the most widely applied of all remedies in bedrock. But there are some special considerations, of course. Again, it comes down to how fluid is moving at your site. And recognize or understand that the capture zone geometry, because of that, is going to be a lot more complex than porous media. And so it's going to have to back it up with a lot of modeling and field observations, something we'll talk about in the case study at the end of this section. Slide 89, permeable reactive barrier zones. And I can speak from experience with this with rock, that identifying the fracture depths is an absolutely critical part of this type of an approach. You can inject materials to create permeable reactive zones in rock fractures. Not necessarily that easy to do, but targeting those water-bearing fractures, very careful coring and logging to identify their depths, and then understanding that this treatment approach could be ineffective if you miss a transmissive fracture. A couple other factors considered here is that you know, your injected media, dependent upon the nature of it, it could affect fluid flow itself. And perhaps think about this more as an approach to use at sites with significant secondary porosity, or that fracture control porosity, as opposed to, say, matrix porosity controlled site. Slide 90, chemical and biological technologies. We'll start with chemical oxidation and chemical reduction. There are some documents, MyTRC documents, specifically on these technologies in general that that do talk a little bit about their application in bedrock. Now, those same concepts apply in terms of how fracture distribution will affect reagent distribution for both of these types of technologies. Another factor, for example, with chemical oxidation, permanganate solutions is one example, can be very dense. Because of that, they can follow density-driven flow, not unlike what was discussed earlier with how a DNAPL might move according to following fracture, strike, and dip. An important factor, a lesson that I've learned the hard way in the past, oxygen demand in fractured rock is generally really low. And again, this is a factor that to consider, that the reagent in this case moving through a fracture zone is encountering much less surface area than, say, reagent moving through an overburden or granular overburden where it's moving around each of those particles. And it's that surface area, those interactions with the rock matrix, that are driving most of the oxygen demand. Another important factor is long-lived oxygens, such as permanganate or perhaps persulfate, can actually diffusively penetrate into rock, and that can be a very good thing as well. and that napples will have a much less interfacial surface area for reaction and overburden, because you basically have that interface at the water napple interface, and it's not spread around all the grains of a granular overburden. Let's move on to slide 91. Bioremediation and modern natural attenuation, also very widely applied. If you're injecting reagents to support bioremediation, for example, the same issues with reagent distribution apply. It has recently been recognized that there are microbes actually living in the rock matrix, in the primary porosity. They do migrate into the primary porosity. It's not really well known, their ability to survive and degrade contaminants, but they are there. And so that's an important consideration. Moving to slide 92, let's talk a few minutes or a few moments about combined remedies. Now, this was really emphasized, I think, in the IDSS document, and that the remedial paradigm has shifted to think much more about combined remedies. You know, no longer think about one remedy taking a site from beginning to end, but rather shifting between remedies as a site evolves in order to emphasize their strengths and minimize their weaknesses. And I think that's especially important in rock because of the modifications of the technologies to be able to apply them. And you can apply them in both spatial or temporal separation. You have to think very carefully about how the remedies will interact with each other. Again, something we considered in depth in the IDSS document. But because those transport mechanisms in rock can be very different in how quickly a reagent that you might inject at point A can show up in point B, that can really affect either a positive or a negative interaction if you're trying to combine different technologies at point A and point B, for example. And the 21-compartment model might be able to help you sort of develop and communicate some of those strategies. Now let's move on to slide 93. We certainly encourage doing bench and field pilot tests of remedies at rock sites. It's very important, I think, to evaluate the treatability, those rock chemistry interactions, reagent distribution. I mean, you can really only do this effectively. For example, reagent distribution can really only effectively be evaluated in the field. But those rock chemistry interactions are very important. Again, it goes back to surface area. And what I have seen done in the past in some cases, let's say, for example, a chemical oxidation or a chemical oxidant demand test, a core would be collected, and the core section would be crushed, and the oxidant demand test would be conducted on that crushed rock. Well, that's going to give you a very, very misleading oxidant demand, because you've exposed a lot of fresh, unweathered rock and mineral surfaces to exposure to the oxidant that wouldn't be exposed to in a field application. And you've also exposed orders of magnitude more surface area that you would not be exposed to in the field. So when I've had to do this in rock, what I've basically done is take my rock core and would actually coat the outside, that cut surface of the core, with a material, you know, a polyurethane, for example, to prevent it from reacting, so that we only get reactions with that rock fracture surface, which gives you a more representative example. And again, that fracture control groundwater flow can be much faster in rock than in overburden. Now let's move to slide 94. We're going to go back to that same case study in a moment, and we're going to talk that Ryan has also introduced, the Solvent Recovery Services of New England case study. We're going to see how hydraulic containment was modeled to support the remedial design and illustrate the multiple lines of evidence to confirm that the remedy is protective. So, moving now to slide 95, the groundwater remedy at the site, it was hydraulic containment of the VOC plume by pump and treat with M&A of the plume both inside and outside of that capture zone. They conducted extensive modeling as part of the feasibility study, and they determined they estimated that the bedrock VOC plume might take as much as about 225 years to attenuate. So that was factored into the record decision as well. And what this slide shows is for particle tracking, you can see the tracks here. Remember, north is to the right. There's a river that is down to the east, down here. And the groundwater plume is generally moving from right to left to the south. So as the flow, or basically the modeling predicted that the plume could be captured with a network of extraction wells and a total pumping rate of about 30 gallons per minute. And as the flow migrates south, it would also rise, and this would be captured as well by the overburden, or captured by extraction within the overburden, I should say. Now, this capture zone boundary along here was interpreted based primarily on three lines of evidence. Number one, the modeling that we talked about, measurements of hydraulic heads in the monitoring wells across the site, and data from groundwater sampling events. And all the monitoring wells that are south of this groundwater capture zone meet the drinking water standards. Now, moving on to the next slide, slide 96. This talks a little bit about the remedy, the basis for remedy selection. And the second component in particular of the groundwater remedy was monitored natural attenuation of groundwater. So to track the progress of MNA, the groundwater is periodically analyzed for typical MNA parameters, DO, ORP, ferrous iron, things of that nature that are redox sensitive so that you can track degradation of the VOCs and also some of the other compounds that are present at the site, such as dioxane and tetrahydrofuran. And what they see overall, a decrease in concentrations, even down gradient of that of where the DNAPL is actually physically observed. And the rates of concentration decline seem to be a lot faster than you would predict just based on the fate and transport modeling that was conducted as part of the feasibility study. And that can be attributed to a number of different options, but probably most likely the DNAPL source term reduction. And as that bedrock DNAPL dissolves, being captured in part by the groundwater extraction system, perhaps also some abiotic degradation mechanisms because the bedrock at the site is very iron rich. An additional component talked about a little bit here is that the conditions are very conducive to degradation of the target compounds. But to really confirm that, they did some genetic analyses to confirm that the right types of degrading bacteria are present to actually destroy the compounds of concern. So at this point, I will turn it over now to John Dougherty, and he is going to discuss the last piece of this puzzle, which is monitoring of our fractured rock sites. John?
Thank you, Dan. Well, as Dan indicated, I'm going to talk now about monitoring during the implementation of the remedy. So, you know, we start off looking at what the objectives are of our monitoring program, and that's driven primarily by the results of the site characterization program and the information that we need to ensure that the selected remedy is performing properly. And to do that, you know, we need to understand there's different types of monitoring that are typically need to be undertaken. Compliance monitoring to assess how well we're doing with respect to regulatory requirements and particular protection of human health and the environment. Operational monitoring of the system itself to see how well it's performing in terms of meeting the objectives for the system. And then progress or performance monitoring over time to assess the progress towards attainment of our objectives. Typically, the media that we're going to be monitoring is primarily groundwater, but it may often also include surface water and in some cases subsurface or soil gas, as well as aquifer matrix materials. Monitoring network design is like the design of the wells used during site characterization, is driven by the characteristics of the rock and primarily the fracture network and orientation, location of potential sensitive receptors is also very important. And sometimes things like hydrogeochemical zoning may also be important. The location of a particular monitoring well is a function of where it is in the fracture network at the site and where it is with respect to groundwater flow and gradient, and then the geochemistry at that location. So the examples of types of monitoring wells or monitoring locations include wells located in the source zone, wells located down gradient of the source in the area that's impacted, as well as further down gradient and distal portions of the plume, or what we might call sentinel wells between the source or impacted area and a sensitive receptor, as well as wells located up gradient and cross gradient. And obviously, the network that's used to monitor remedy performance is going to be built on the network that was set up for characterization and then supplemented as needed. So here's an example of the kind of analysis and data that goes into the design of a monitoring well, whether it's for remedy monitoring or characterization. And what you see here is an example, a screenshot from a piece of software that's used to integrate data like this. We have data from three different sources, our geophysical subcontractor. This was collected during one field mobilization, and then a flute transmissivity profile in a subsequent event, and then downhole groundwater sampling that was conducted separately. It's really important that somebody in your team, whether it's in your agency or company or a subcontractor, has the ability to integrate information like this over time, because it usually takes multiple sources of information like this. In this case, we put this information together and then use it to design, in this case, a flute multiport well, where we're focusing on the highly transmissive interval, for example, here for one of our monitoring ports. Earlier, there was a question about how we determine the orientation of features in the borehole. So here's an example of an optical televiewer and acoustic televiewer. And then on top of that, you see sinusoidal waves. That's a what's called a structure log that's added by the analyst. And then the same information can be presented as what's called a tadpole here. So that's an example of how you get the orientation information. EPA guidance for monitoring during remedies talks about monitoring during remedy operation, monitoring remedy progress towards achievement of RAOs, and then attainment of those RAOs. So let's look at a case study from a site in South Carolina where they're monitoring groundwater and surface water. The conceptual model at the site is a weathered bedrock zone grading into competent rock, in this case metamorphic rock with low matrix porosity. They've identified the fractures in rock as predominantly subhorizontal, and they've been able to identify the water-bearing fractures. So with that information, they have a set of 15 wells in the source area, 37 wells monitoring down gradient of that and adjacent to it, and then in particular a set of wells up gradient and down gradient of the ZVI barrier, which is part of the remediation strategy. And then they're also monitoring surface water periodically. Now I'm going to go back to the solvent recovery site, which we've had some examples from before, and we're going to look at how the monitoring well network for this site was designed and methods that they used to mine existing data to optimize their monitoring program. So looking first of all at the site conceptual model, we have a shallow bedrock zone in the upper 30 feet of the site and then the deeper bedrock zone. And these were defined based on a core packer testing and geophysical logs. They've been conducting annual sampling for VOCs and then sampling less frequently for M&A parameters. They've been using a combination of sampling techniques, no purge in areas or wells with high concentrations of VOCs on the order of, say, 10,000 micrograms, and then low-flow sampling where attainment of MCLs is very important, say at sentinel wells, downgradient of the source area. Now, they have a lot of data from this site. So what they did was they sat down and they applied the ITRC guidance called Groundwater Statistics for Monitoring and Compliance to evaluate the trends in this data. So you're looking at data from over a period of 7 years, sampling every 2 years. And they analyzed the trends in the different wells to decide if it was increasing, the concentration was increasing, decreasing, or not changing. And so this is important to take away from this is very often we have a large historical data set at many sites, and that's valuable information that can be used. And then they go through an exercise that's discussed in the guidance of taking away data, if you will, to see what effect it has on the trends that they've defined. And through that process, they determined that they could sample every 2 years and still see the same trends at the locations that they had seen with the more frequent sampling. So they met with their regulators and they presented this information and negotiated a reduced sampling frequency, which, you know, saved valuable project resources without sacrificing attainment of monitoring of trends, which are important towards understanding remedy, how well we're progressing towards the remedy. So to summarize, you know, what we've tried to do today is address, you know, the perception that fractured rock sites are too complicated to characterize or remediate. We have, you know, reviewed the differences between fractured rock sites and unconsolidated sites. We've looked at what it takes to develop good conceptual models of sites, the kinds of tools that are necessary for characterization, how to apply that to remedial action objectives and remedy selection, and then the monitoring of those remedies. One of the important resources as part of this guidance is the tools matrix, which is a downloadable Excel spreadsheet that gives you an overview of the kinds of tools, the range of tools that are available for site characterization and what they can be used for to help you filter down to the kind of tools that may be applicable to your site. And this is intended to be a resource that we update periodically. So our goal here has been to, and in this guidance document going forward, is to emphasize the development of good conceptual site models, setting realistic remedial objectives, and selecting the best remedial option, and then monitoring progress in that objective so that your team can be confident in the decisions that you're making and go beyond simply trying to contain and monitor groundwater contamination at sites like this to actually remediating the sites. And with that, I'll turn it over back to our moderator.
Thanks, John. We now are going to have time for questions. So all participants are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. I also have a final couple of poll questions for people to answer as we're going through this. If you're in the phone line audience, please jump in with questions. Remember #6 to unmute. Before we get to those questions, I do want to mention our links to additional resources. Our trainers have mentioned several other ITRC guidance documents. Those are available on this links to additional resources page. It also gives you a link back to the document that's the basis of today's training, as well as you can download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. We also include a link here to our feedback form, and we ask that everyone complete the feedback. We really do use the information. If you're interested in a participation certificate for attending today's class, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and that's going to allow the system to generate the certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, submit again, because right now the only way to generate that certificate is by filling out the feedback form and checking the box at the bottom. I also want to mention our trainers, Ryan on slide 50 mentioned the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization document. We do have a training coming up on March 8th. If you're interested, please register for that. And also, just recently, John mentioned another document where we have an upcoming training, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers, and that's on March 27th. So if you are interested in these upcoming classes, please look at the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org, or the CLUIN website to register for the classes. A couple of questions have come in. I thought most bedrock wells were open hole, not screened.
I can address that.
Go ahead, John.
Go ahead, Michael. Do you want to take it?
No, you go for it.
Okay. In fact, I was just typing a response here to the question. I think that obviously the design of a particular well depends on its function and purpose. An open hole might be appropriate for, in particular, let's say, for example, an extraction well. The problem with an open hole well is that you typically are going to be interconnecting fractures at different depths, which may have different heads in them and different concentrations, and creating a vertical conduit for contaminant migration. So as a general rule, we want to be very careful about where we drill open holes and how long we leave them open. We like to line boreholes as quick right after they're drilled, for example, so that we can prevent vertical contaminant migration or even worse, migration of DNAPL, and then develop a well design based on the data that we've collected from the borehole, whether it's a rock core or geophysical logging or combination of those, and then install a monitoring well. Could be a screened well, it could be a multiport well, but in general we want the zone, the monitoring zone's probably going to be relatively short because we want to monitor a specific transmissive zone and we want to prevent the connection, vertical interconnection of different zones in the rock.
Yeah, this is Ryan. I think the distinction is, and I should have maybe been a little more clear when I made the statement on that slide. What we're talking about, you know, if you're installing an open hole, you know, that maybe intersects 50, 100, 300 feet of, you know, the bedrock aquifer, because you're trying to log the whole thing, and then you leave that open. That's different than if you know the zone that you want to target and you're leaving, you know, a 5 or a 10 foot open borehole because you're going to sample a specific zone. So I think that's the clarification that I would add.
Yeah, if we were going to drill a long open hole for characterization purposes, like you're talking about, we would typically line it right after it's drilled, put a blank liner into it, and then take the liner out, do things like borehole geophysics, put the liner back in, and then complete the well design. And we might include the backfilling part of the borehole as part of that once we have the information out of the borehole.
There's a number of references by Beth Parker where they found this out the hard way, and it's worth looking up again for this. There's definitely some interesting case studies.
Can you discuss further options for creating integrated borehole logs? What software do you use to integrate the geophysical, hydrogeologic, chemical, et cetera, data for a single borehole?
Mm-hmm. This is John. I'll take that. The example I showed you here in this presentation was prepared in WellCAD. That is a program sold by a company called ALT, Advanced Logic Technology, out of Luxembourg. It's the one that I'm most familiar with and experienced with. It's a very widely used tool. Most borehole geophysical contractors that you'll be working with or you might work with will use that tool. There might be others out there, but I'm not really, you know, familiar with them or aware of them. I think it's I'm not making any kind of endorsement of the product. I'm just telling you what my experience has been.
Yeah, and you'll notice in the document we actually tried to not endorse specific products, and that even includes, you know, like Flute. So we tried to use the generic terms, mm-hmm. just because we don't want to endorse specific products, but also then, you know, that way we don't have to modify the document when something new comes out. But yeah, in terms of things that, you know, practitioners actually use, I think it's good to be able to talk about that in this kind of a setting. But we didn't publish the names in the document, so that's why that may have seemed a little lacking. We did that on purpose.
We never endorse anything.
Right. And let me just add on that point briefly. What you're looking for in a tool, like I've been showed the example here, is a tool that can read borehole geophysical data from the instrument and also allow you to enter information like well construction information, other just simple text that you want to display with depth. So that's the kind of tool you're looking for.
How do we read more about the various case studies discussed in the presentations? The person asking can't find them in the online document.
They're in the appendix. When you're on the online document, it's really important to maximize it, or you're going to lose some of the functionality. And we have a lot of case studies in the appendices, I believe.
How do you assess vapor intrusion and risk if it's a mostly fracture-driven? Would you have to install vapor wells close to the building, or would a vapor well closer to the source be sufficient?
I think that's going to be a state-by-state sort of determination. I mean, in my state, we want to see what's under the building if we're worried about vapor intrusion. But as you're characterizing the site, you may want to use something like a sorb, you know, passive samplers around areas to look for patterns. There's no one real straightforward answer to that, I don't believe.
In addition to the tools reference, have any of the presenters used subvertical boreholes to facilitate investigations? Does the ITRC guidance document discuss this?
It's not discussed in the document. I've never really used them, but 35 years ago, I drilled some in Southeast Ohio looking for stuff. But I mean, it's not in the document. We didn't really go into it. But I'm sure it's available. The information is out there.
Thank you. Looking at our poll results, are you ready to apply the ITRC fractured rock document at your sites? So we have a lot of people saying yes, thank you, a few no's, and unsure, need to learn more. And we do hope that everyone takes the opportunity to look at the online guidance document to learn more. And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So we have a wide variety of answers. There's a scroll bar along the right, so you can scroll through to see some of the answers that have come in. Some people are going to develop a CSM. They're going to integrate the tools. They're going to update their site investigation method. So you're welcome to scroll through and see the different answers that are available for that. I will give it another minute or so to see if more questions come in. While we're waiting, I'll point out some upcoming training classes. So on March 8, Thursday, we have the Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization, and we mentioned this earlier on slide 50 of this presentation. On March 22, Geophysical Classification for Munitions Response. March 27, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. And March 29, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. So I do encourage you to check the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. Also, the CLUIN website. So if you're back on that CLUIN training page where we started today, if you follow the link in the upper left, the CLUIN Sun, that's going to take you to their main page. And if you look over to the right, you're going to see links where you can register for not only ITRC's classes, but other classes that CLUIN is going to provide in the next couple of months. I'll also remind you at this point, we do look for you to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. It doesn't take long to fill out. We're going to use that information as we're developing new courses, as we're improving this training course. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you would like a certificate, you can complete the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. And once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. If you have multiple